Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-DM,
McGill. That's me.
And what we have today for you on January 26th, 2021, is episode 47. No more messing around with sessions, numbers, and all that other stuff. We just gotta get right into it. I am continuing to talk about Operation Conqueror as I began last time, and I believe we are finally kicking off, officially kicking off the beginning of McGill's touring band Eberron game. Is that correct?
That's right. We're getting into Adventure One. I gave sort of the prologue to it last time, but we'll get into it this time.
And last time, I definitely poured out a whole bunch of stuff. I was technically only explaining like one little mini adventure and what I did with it. But, you know, in addition, I had all my session zero sort of prologue stuff and a whole lot of sort of setup. So we are now covering my second campaign, Al's Aces, the sequel to Empok's Finest. But I figured since I did my big kickoff last time to start, we would do your big kickoff this time to start for this episode, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, that's fine by me. I guess I can just launch right into it. So, unless there is any more introduction you want to give.
I don't know. Is there anything more to talk about? I feel like maybe I forgot something, but I don't know. I got the date. I got the episode number.
Yeah, we're not doing session numbers anymore, so...
Exactly. Maybe it's just that that's missing is makes me feel like something's gone, but it's not that important.
So away we go.
Yeah, there we go.
So last time I gave a bunch of introduction to the setting of Eberron. A key part of the setting that factors into this campaign are the dragon-marked houses. How in Eberron, there are these, basically they're like magic birthmarks where the high royal houses are these bloodlines that are all born with these magic symbols on their bodies that allow them to do powerful magic. And outside of the dragon-marked houses, most of the magic is like low level, low impact. And at the time, the part of the timeline that my campaign takes place, the Dragonmarked houses are sending out this sort of like mercenary secret police called the Enforcer Elite to capture and execute anybody who is born with an aberrant Dragonmark, anybody born with one of these marks that is not part of a royal line, as a means of sort of keeping magic within the royal families of Eberron.
It's funny because I remember, you know, when the new Eberron book came out for 5th edition, I remember looking through it, and one of the things that really jumped out at me was those aberrant dragon marks. I was like, ha, that's cool. Those are cool. Aberrant dragon marks in 5th edition, they're cool.
I mean, they are pretty cool, and they'll factor into this campaign in a few ways. And I had also introduced the members of the band that doesn't yet have a name at the start of the campaign. And those members are Alan Dare, who is like Alan Rickman, played by Caitlin, Gabriel, played by Gavin, who is a paladin, Jalen, played by Chris, who is a wizard, Marcus, who is a druid, played by Mike, and then Nikdo, who is He's a masker. He's this like he wears magic masks. That's his thing. It was a special class, and he was played by Steve.
He's a hexadecimer.
Yeah, a hexadecimer.
He's a hexadecimal.
Herxadirksimer. And together they are a band. Their party NPC is a half, a sort of slovenly halfling named Mervin, who acts as their manager.
Hey, what do you got to do to get a show in this town?
Guys, we got a gig at the Cat and Custard Pot Pub.
We got a gig at the Howlin' Wolf. Apparently the sign looks kind of like a pig.
If I had known about the Howling Wolf at the time that I ran this campaign, they'd totally have a gig there. And so they're at the Cat and Custard Pot Pub, which is also an inn in this tiny village called Varna. And they're basically like playing in exchange for a reasonable amount of money. They're allowed to collect tips, and they also get free room and board while they are there. And I had opened the adventure by having a storyteller who was like the act before theirs at the Cat Custard Pot. And he was just like spinning a yarn about all these little like backstory plot points that helped fill in the players on the setting, you know, in case they hadn't done a bunch of reading on Eberron, mentioning things like the dragon-marked houses, legendary heroes, things along those lines. And the storyteller had concluded his story, and that's where I had left off, because the band was up next. So that's where we come in this time. And the band takes their place in front of the fire, and they start playing. And what I did for any time the band played is I would set a DC, but I didn't want it to just be like one person rolls and everybody else aids them or anything like that. So I did kind of a combined performance check, basically. Each band member rolls perform, and then I add all the results together, and that's got to beat the DC, and the audience will react accordingly. And then if the band succeeds by 10 or more, in this case, I had the next event in the adventure is a boy bursting in the doors of the inn with some news. And I had it in my notes that if the band really succeeds on their check, I allow them to finish the set. But if they start failing, if they're doing a bad job, then the boy interrupts them.
I just wanted to also make a shout out to a mechanic in 5th edition that is relevant here. Is 5th edition also, in addition to like the help action and the regular checks that you do, they introduce the group check, which is when basically everyone in the party has to make the ability check, but you need at least half the group to succeed in order for the thing to succeed.
That's cool. Yeah, that's sort of the same idea that I was going for. I didn't actually know about the group check. That's a good mechanic.
It's so funny, because I have become like, I was introduced to the group check, like, you know, I'd been playing 5th edition for Lord knows how long before I saw an Adventurers League module like make reference to the group check, and I was like, what the heck is that? And I looked it up, and I'm like, man, this whole mechanic is there. I never even knew about it.
I still haven't played as much 5th edition as I would have liked. I certainly haven't DM'd a lot of 5th
edition. That's about to change about the plan anyway.
Heck yeah. So and I have the group role play their performance, and you know, they roll their checks, and I, you know, run with it, guys. If everybody starts rolling bad checks, I wanted them to role play playing a bad set and like bombing.
So does Alan Dare sing like this, or does he have a fantastic singing voice?
Well, he has sort of an Alan Rickman singing voice, and if you watch Sweeney Todd, you can decide for yourself how good that actually is.
Yeah, I'm getting Disco Elysium vibes.
So I recalled that they finished their set. They rolled well enough to succeed. It wasn't a high DC. Basically, they all had to get a 10 in order to get their DC, to meet the DC. So they finished their set, and then this young boy bursts through the doors, and he's crying, and he lets in this chilly gust of air, and he says to everybody, "They've got Falsmere." And the bartender like drops what he's doing and goes, "All right, the bar is closed." And he doesn't have to say it twice. Everybody is like getting their cloaks. This is a big deal. But the players have no idea who Falsmere is or what the heck is going on. So soon they're left in this completely empty bar, except for a halfling barmaid who like takes over for the bartender. She like brings a step stool out and stands on it behind the bar. So I let them sort of decide, like, well, what do you do? Everybody's gone. They follow the crowd. And when they get outside, they can see that the crowd has gathered in the square of the small town. And in the square, there's this raised wooden platform that's usually used for like livestock judging competitions or like pie eating contests or things like that. But it's not a fun atmosphere at this point, because standing on the riser is seven Enforcer Elite, and they've got these black, you know, black armor studded with like spiked studs, and they wear these hooded black cloaks, this mercenary order.
Evil and two bad of them guys.
Yeah, they're the big bads, and two of them are holding a kobold who wears brown robes, and then one of them, who's this half-orc, and he's obviously the captain, he's like showboating around the platform, swinging his sword threateningly as he addresses the crowd. And I let the players roll some knowledge checks to see if they knew what the heck was going on, and at least one of them did well enough to know that the kobold is a local druid who makes his money healing livestock and like helping farmers' crops grow. And then the Enforcer Elite, they have this reputation for being merciless, and local legend has it that the captain is immune to magic. So there's this like, you know, odd standoff going on, and the captain of the Enforcer Elite, you know, is shouting at the crowd.
Sounds like some sort of aberrant Draven Mark feature, if you ask me.
Oh, you are right, sir. So he shouts at the crowd to shut up, and he unwinds a scroll.
So the Enforcer Elite are supposed to hunt the aberrant marks, but this Enforcer Elite guy has an aberrant mark?
Well,
as I've deduced.
Not quite. The Enforcer Elite hunt the aberrant marks, and the captain of the Enforcer Elite is a low-ranking member of one of the Dragon Mark houses. So his mark is not aberrant. However, he reads out the law from the scroll saying, you know, practitioners of the magical arts not in the employ of the Dragon Mark houses are subject to immediate detention and imprisonment, but any magic user found to be in possession of an aberrant Dragon Mark is to be executed on sight. And he tears off a swath of the kobold's cloak, and there's a Dragon Mark on the druid's shoulder, a Dragon Mark of healing. And so, you know, the crowd erupts in shouting as Falsmere is forced down to the front of the platform, and they like lower his head onto a cross section of log, and they're going to execute him right there. And the captain, whose name is Davror the orc, he puts a foot on Falsmere's back and he raises his sword and he goes, you know, you've been found guilty of infringing upon the law, the Treaty of Sigilstar. And as he's reading it out, suddenly a lizard, which is Falsmere's familiar, scurries out of his robes and skitters across the platform towards Davror to defend the familiar's druid. And Davror just slices the lizard in two and he goes, your punishment is death. And so, you know, there's this moment where Falsmere struggles and he tries to get to his feet and he's trying to cast a spell. And then Davror removes his gauntlet and exposes a dragon mark on the palm of his hand. And I gave the players the option to roll, you know, knowledge arcana. I don't think any of them did, but it's a mark of captivation. And so he basically hypnotizes Falsmere with his dragon mark and then executes him right there. Cuts his head off with a sword. One of the enforcers bags Falsmere's head. Davor sheathes his sword. And then he turns to the audience and then dramatically shouts the crowd again, saying, like, remember the law, none are exempt. His gaze lingers on the party. And then they get on their horseback and they ride off into the night. And in the wake of this, like, sudden drama, cold rain starts to fall. And I just sort of let the players react to all this. Mervin says, you know, we might as well stay at the inn since we have free food and lodgings for another night. You may recall on a past episode that I read out some tavern menus that I had prepared. I used the cat and custard pot menu. Some of those items were in that list. So I won't bother going through the menu, but I provide the food and drink menu once again. And just for that,
come up in my session. So
action there. For that added flavor. And the next morning, the party meets again in the inn, and they're all sort of trying to decide where to go. Mervin says he's got a few leads on some gigs, and I gave the players different options about, you know, where they wanted to go next. I had this map of Eberron that I'll post on the WordPress, and, you know, I gave them some options. Do you want to go to Thrain or to Fairhaven? Do you want to go to Rote or Merrill's Ward? You could catch a ship to Stormholm. And they sort of are discussing, like, where they want to go. And it was fun just allowing the players to look at the map and be like, well, this area looks kind of interesting. Or, oh, why don't we go over there? Because I don't think any of them had, like, done any in-depth reading on Eberron. So they were just sort of, you know, on a whim deciding their next direction. But, of course, I wasn't going
to
let them...
stuff. I like to get a fantasy map and just roam around, see what I see.
Yeah.
What's that place? Let's go check it out.
But, of course, I wasn't going to let them go off quite yet. This was actually good because I don't think I had fully planned any of those adventures. Like, I had a few paragraphs of notes on each. And this way, the players could pick the next adventure or the next destination they wanted to head to. And it would give me some time to really flesh out that adventure, even though I had an idea of what they were going to do next. So they eat their last free meal in Varna, and then they hear some commotion outside. They head outside, and they can see that a crowd has gathered on the bridge in front of the inn. There's a bridge that goes over the river. And everybody's leaning over the side to see something in the river. And they look in, and there's this thick black mass of ichor that's covering the river's surface. And in the center of it is the corpse of a large deer with its head ripped clean off. And the villagers are all really troubled. The players sort of listened in, and and villagers are going like, it's an omen. You know, it's a harbinger of the forest's wrath. And somebody's saying, you know, we killed a druid. We let him die. His blood is on our soil. You know, murmur. Without any clean river water, my cows aren't going to be happy, nor my hogs. And we'll be without drinking water, too. This isn't good. You know, and some are saying, like, oh, it'll be washed away. This is no big deal. And as this is all going on, a small boy tugs on his father's shirt, and he points at the sword hanging on the paladin's hip. And the man's face lights up, and he turns and he says, you, I say, you're adventurers. You must be. No one carries a sword in the reaches that doesn't know how to use it. And so the villagers implore the players to investigate the matter for them. We're just farmers, merchants, and hosts, except for the guards across the river, but we're only concerned with our affairs. We can provide you food or whatever services you need. What little money we have could be yours, if you solve our problem, of course. And I also included in my notes some alternatives. You know, if the party refuses, maybe the crowd will plead with them, could grow ugly, or maybe the guards across the river from the village could ask for the hero's help to quell the disturbance, whatever it takes to get them invested in this adventure hook. But they pretty much took it right away. I think I also, on a previous episode, talked about the Wilderness Encounters table. I think I talked about that.
You may have.
Pretty sure. So I have a really good Wilderness Encounters table. And the players agree that they're going to investigate the matter of, you know, what's going on. Why is the river suddenly filled with black ichor and this grotesque, like, ripped apart deer corpse? And they're going to start their investigation at Falsmir's cabin, which is about 10 kilometers up the river at the base of a waterfall. They can get there by taking the road north. And on the way there, I had them roll on the random encounter table, and I can't recall what they rolled. So, Tom, why don't you just roll percentile dice?
Oh, man. Okay. Get my old, my good roller. These days, you know, let's talk dice rollers online. You know, I've always been a fan of the fact that on Google, you can just say roll 1d6 or whatever. But you know what? As far as I know, type roll 1d100 doesn't do it. Let me try. Yep, doesn't work. So these days, what I've been using is a site called rolls.org. It's rolz.org. And you just punch in the dice and you roll it and it keeps a record. And oh my God, guess what I got?
100?
69.
Nice. It's like one of the least interesting encounters on this table, which is an unattended large pile of acorns.
Oh man, but it's probably got a sexy dryad under there. This sexy 69.
There are a lot of fun wilderness encounters on here, and the players did a lot of wilderness travel, like going through forests and stuff, especially because one of them was a druid. So I use this a lot. We'll come back to it, I'm sure, in a future adventure. But this time they found a big pile of acorns. Who knows? They arrive at Falsmir's cottage, and it's hidden by the foliage. It's sort of concealed. It's concealed under the thick foliage, and then next to the cottage is a tree. And the tree, unbeknownst to the players, is hollowed out, and more of the cottage is sort of within its hollowed out trunk. So they arrive at the waterfall, which towers over the clearing. They can't see over the top of the falls. The drop from the top of the falls is sheer, but the landscape on either side is sloped in a way that makes it seem navigable if they want to climb up. And then at the base of the waterfall, there's sort of like a druid circle with three menhirs clustered together near the bottom of the tree that's next to Falsmir's cottage.
It's a weird word, menhir.
Menhir. I know that entirely because of Asterix. So
what's a menhir?
The menhir?
Yeah, what's that?
What's a menhir? A menhir, yeah. It's one of those tall sort of oblong stones. Like, you know Asterix, right?
Yeah.
You know Obelix, how he's always carrying around a big stone on his back?
Yeah.
That's a menhir.
It's kind of like a monolith.
Yeah, it's a bit like, it's like a rounded monolith. So they start exploring Falsmir's cottage, and the shtick with Falsmir, I had sort of written, you know, a bit of personality for him, even though he's now dead. But he really likes using magic wards and runes. And man, if I had thought to use the exploding ruin, this would have been a good place for it. But they explore his cottage and they find the door that leads into the tree trunk. And then his sleeping chamber is like little sleeping nook is inside the tree. So there's like a ladder that goes up to a trap door. And then they go inside the trapdoor, and there's the sleeping nook with a small shelf of books, and there's a chest at the foot of his bed. And sure enough, one of the players opens the chest and triggers a trap, and the trap makes the trapdoor slam shut and lock, and then fill the room with stinking, like a stinking cloud of gas. And so after they've thoroughly searched his cottage, and being my players, they of course like loot the hell out of it, even though it's like this poor unjustly killed druid, but they stole a bunch of his stuff.
Well, he's not going to need it anymore.
Fair enough. they don't really find anything of note, but they do, you know, learn a bit about him, specifically that he uses wards and ruins quite a bit. And then they decide, okay, you know, there's nothing here. We might as well check at the top of the waterfall. And the water in this area is clear, but they didn't really notice the point at the river where that black ichor dissipates. So they decide, all right, let's check the top of the waterfall. And I had them roll some climb checks. The terrain on either side of the falls alternates between like slippery mud and then shelves of jagged rock and spindly trees as well that can assist in climbing. And I had it that it was a tricky climbing check with a penalty for the mud, but failure just means the character falls and takes some non-lethal damage, like gets the wind knocked out of them. They reach the top of the ridge with the waterfall to their right, and they're like standing on the shore. And as soon as they get to the top, they notice that the air is just rank with this awful stench of like rotting meat and feces. And they step forward and learn, of course, their noses didn't lie, and they step directly into a big black liquid turd that reeks horribly. You know, encourage the players to role play their reactions to it.
Is there going to be an Odiug around here?
Oh, yeah, not an Odiug, but you're getting the right idea. So they look around, and the forest floor in this area is just full of black shit puddles. And as they walk closer to the river's edge, they notice that the ground is a bit cleaner there. No turds on the gravel beach next to the fast-moving water. And there is some, you know what, I'll read this out, but then I'll talk about it. There is something the players didn't notice here that would have been kind of a shortcut to like a different solution to the problem they're about to face.
All right.
So there's a flicker of movement upriver. They look up north.
I'm curious, like this water, have they been checking it? You've been mentioning the water's clear. Is it like clear of life? Is it the sort of thing where like maybe this water is like killing all the fish or something?
It's not clear of life. There are fish in it, but it really was a case of like there was just this black. Did you ever see like Creepshow 2? You ever see the movie Creepshow 2?
I don't think I've seen Creepshow 2.
Well, there's this one of the anthology stories in Creepshow 2. This couple goes to a lake and they swim out to a raft, and then this big like cloudy black ooze starts filling the lake. And in that case, it turned out to be a sentient blob that was trying to kill them. But that's sort of the imagery I was looking for. It's just like this black Icarus mass in the water that had poured downstream.
Black pudding?
Black pudding. No, not black pudding. Black pudding's way better. Anyway.
You get a lot of use out of black puddings in D&D.
You'll find out what's going on in just a second, because they notice a big stag walk out of the forest and start drinking at the edge of the water. And with a sudden bellow, a big brown bear charges out of the forest and bounds through the water and then pounces on top of the stag and chomps down on its neck and wrestles the creature to the ground. And as it's doing that, with a cracking of branches, this 12-foot giant wades out into the water. And as it makes its way across the river to where the bear is attacking the stag, it's looking around, and the players can see that it only has one eye. It's a cyclops. And it's clearly male, as it wears no clothes. It's really ugly. It's covered in scars and blemishes. And the bear is basically like its pet. So the cyclops goes over and it claps a hand on the bear's shoulder and pushes it aside easily. And the bear licks the blood off its chops and sort of circles around the cyclops like a dog around its master. And the cyclops reaches down and twists the stag's head, rips it off, just like rips it directly from its body. And then it cracks its skull against the cyclops' knee, like splitting a melon. And then it starts scooping out the deer's brains and slurping on them. And then when it's finished eating, it lets out this big rumbling belch, gets to its feet, wades out into the river, and then just takes a giant Icarus shit right into the river while eating the stag. And it's a revolting sight.
This isn't, based on the stool samples, I'd say it's not a very healthy diet. It's
definitely not a healthy diet. And so this is where I hand the reins over to the players. How do you deal with this? They ultimately decided to just fight the Cyclops. And they did it. And they were successful. They managed to kill it. and no more shit pouring into the river. But there was another option. If they had rolled spot or search to search the area, they would have found a silver rod that has a ward of suggestion on it. And when the rod is planted upright in the ground, it would keep the Cyclops from shitting in the river. And the druid had put it there. So basically what had happened, the full story, is that the druid had died, and then it rained, and the rod fell over. So the Cyclops started crapping in the river once again. But the players chose the violent approach. They did not investigate enough to find that silver rod of warding, and instead they just kill the Cyclops and make sure its body is not left in the river. And then they head back to Varna. And I had a note here as well, which is, if the players like are moving at a good pace, run another wilderness encounter on the way back to town. But this session had run long enough at that point. So they head back to town, and they're greeted by a crowd of villagers who have been steadily emerging from their houses since they came into sight. Some of them applaud you, and they're each presented with some gold and given whatever they like that the villagers can offer. And the main thing that they took was they each got a horse, and Mervyn got a horse and then a wagon to attach to it as well. That could sort of be their transport to their next destination.
Their tour bus.
Yeah, basically. So that was adventure one.
I like it. I like the succinct. I like that there's the mystery with the different ways it could unfold. I was a bit surprised nobody did anything when they were executing that kobold, but I guess they were pretty low level.
Pretty low level. I gave them the option, but it was funny. I remember too, like wondering, like, are they going to intervene? But it seemed like one of those things where they were like, "We're not from here. This is not our problem. Don't get involved." And yeah, it was fun. As I mentioned on our last episode, like, this is the first just straight up D&D campaign that I've talked about on this show. And that's the way I approached it. Like, do those sort of classic D&D setups, you know, go and explore a druid's cabin and have some traps in there. And then, you know, what's going on? The river's been polluted and the villagers want you to help them. Just sort of like these simple lower level encounters and adventures. That's how I basically approach the whole thing.
Well, there's a fair number of interesting connections between your game and my game this time with my Operation Conqueror. Whoa, shall I jump into my end of it?
Does yours have a pooping Cyclops too?
No, I don't like poop stuff in my games. Get that poop out of here.
Normally I wouldn't do any poop stuff in my games. Like, I'm not one for like toilet humor, but what I wanted to do with this one is I wanted to make the players think that it was like something magical was polluting the river, you know, an omen from the forest gods or something. And then
something gross.
Exactly. Have it, in fact, just be something kind of mundane. And like when the Cyclops comes out too, it's like, is the Cyclops casting a spell? No, the Cyclops is just pooping in the river. it's a good level one problem to solve.
I don't know, man, though. Those poops, I would have had him, like, eating something pretty gross to make that happen, but I don't know. It seems like stag meat would have just given him normal diet.
Oh, there's stag brains, though, remember.
That's true. Maybe you get the jitters. So, from the cat and custard pot, that's what it is, right?
That's right. Based on a real place.
Over to the Barking Dog Inn in Goblin Town. Not to be confused with the Howling Wolf. This one's just a barking dog. But
my headcanon says that they're part of a chain.
Well, the Barking Dog is a front for an MPOC base. It's run by the human hostess Abigail, sort of on the outskirts of Goblin Town, like it's an inn for people traveling in and out, but it is also secretly an MPOC base. And last time, The players had had dinner there with the hostess, Abigail. Their boss, Al Samasath, or Al, showed up to have them pose as buyers for a mysterious item, which turned out to be fake. But once all that was done, the deal was done, and all was said and done, they were level two, and they returned to the Barking Dog, where they slept. And then for the next adventure, they got up and they had breakfast, again, enjoying their breakfast with the hostess, Abigail. And I have written here that they were enjoying waffles and omelets that were made from emu eggs and little elk bits. And also there was some figs. So a nice round breakfast. Al Samasath, Al, he shows up with a job. He says they got a they had an agent named Axel. We may have met him in the first campaign, I'm not sure. But Axel was deployed to the lands of Stench, which we know from the last campaign is north of the Goblin Town, just north of Goblin Town. And he's been captured. They got to rescue a captured Goblin Empok agent from some sort of hideout in the land of Stench, some sort of criminal hideout. So the players go, they track their way through the lands of Stench. I had a little survival roll that I think was with advantage because of Nessaly was a ranger, so she had proficiency with like scouting through the swamplands, basically. And so depending on their survival roll, it affected like how many goblins were going to be in the hideout when they got there. And when they got there, so this is what's interesting. I guess one thing I should say is that I know that one investment that the players had made is that Chessie, the drow rogue, had gone to the trouble of buying a ghillie suit and an Artemis hunting rifle. So basically she's set up to be like sort of a low-level hunter or a low-level sniper. And they found this sort of goblin base. It's sort of like in a little cave in the land of Stench. And she set up like a sniper position. The other players went in, cleric and the ranger. However, what really sticks out in my mind about this session is that what's funny is that so like the goblin hideout is, imagine like there's a corridor going into the cave and then there's a turn right, but in at like where that turn is, the wall in front of like that first passage has like arrow slits in it. So theoretically a guard can like watch the front passage and shoot into it with arrows if they see an intruder coming. What's funny about this is that I remember the players, particularly the player who played Chessie, reasoned from that setup that it was going to be impossible to sneak by. And this could not be further from the truth. The DC was really low. And the reason that I think what sort of happened here is the goblins behind that arrow slit, like the guard, they weren't really paying attention. It's not like they sit there just looking out into the passage the whole day. They're lazy ass goblin guards. They get distracted. They do stuff. And so it's almost like, it's funny. I recently saw in a show I was watching, they had one of these situations where there's like, the characters have to deal with like a survivalist who has like sort of a compound, and he comes out with a gun, but he's also got like a window where he has a sniper rifle, like very obviously set up in the window. And when he's negotiating, he says like my son's armed too. And he points towards the sniper rifle. But then like later in the episode, when the characters get in, they check that window and there's no one behind it. It's like a Home Alone situation with like a bike wheel where he can like just make it look like someone is in the sniper position when he sees someone coming. And that's basically what happened to the players, is they saw this like route of entrance and they just like immediately assumed they're going to see us coming in. There's no way we can sneak by. They could have easily, like, snuck in that cave entrance, like, crawled in, any sort of things. But they didn't even bother. I think what happened was they, like, openly sort of entered and then tried to use, like, the sniper cover to, like, have the advantage. But it's just very funny to me because, like, the players reasoned something in that case that in my head I was like, well, that's not true.
I love that.
But I couldn't really... There wasn't really... It wasn't one of those situations that I talk about where it's the writer's room where, like, I can say as the audience member, like, well, this doesn't make sense. In that position, it was like, they don't know.
They've made that assumption, so they just have to roll. If they make that assumption.
So, I mean, also further in, so there's like an alarm system with little bells that the guard has access to. Also further in past that turn, there's a tripwire that is, it's both like a falling stones trap, but it's also attached to the alarm as well. And I have specifically marked that they did not like disarm the tripwire or anything. So I think they just full on walked into it and like set off the alarm, got hit by rocks, like Chessie's sniping from the outside. They're trying to sort of pull goblins outside by like fighting them inside and then drawing them out. The goblins had a couple of wargs that they had caged, so things were pretty like intense on the inside. And because like basically the players lost a lot of surprise because they just like the alarm had been set off. They hadn't been doing a lot to like sneak in because they assumed that they were just going to be going in loud. And it's also like, basically this was just an early session that really went in ways that I didn't expect. Like another thing I had was like the leader of this sort of like, goblin gang out in the land of stench that had like, they'd captured a few people who had like wandered in their territory. And like this MPOC agent was just one of them. But the thing to say about it is like, so I had things like there were a bunch of goblins in the lair, but then there was the bugbear who was like the leader. And if they killed the bugbear, then the goblins would surrender. But they like that was not, it wasn't like they killed the bugbear first. They ended up fighting the goblins first. And then the bugbear actually managed to take down, both Nessalie and Arakendor. It became a thing where it was just Chessie against the bugbear. Although there was another unexpected thing where they, like, I think one of them chose to unlock the cages for the captives before they had finished fighting the bugbear. And so I also had to like sort of add in this thing. I think the way that I measured it basically was I had, when Chessie came in to fight the bugbear, I had the prisoners count as like allies for the purposes of her sneak attack. And so basically like I was able to add in like, well, since you unlock the cage while like this fight is going badly, but the prisoners are all going to come out and try and help you basically. And so yeah, it was basically like I was just having to make up a lot of stuff on the fly because I had things set up like the goblins surrender if the bugbear goes down. That didn't happen. It was like the other way around. Goblins first, then bugbear. You know, I had ready for the cell to be open. I had the DC and everything. I was not expecting the cell to be opened before the bugbear was defeated. And so I had to take that into account. And so, yeah, it was like a bunch of interesting things that all played into this one pretty classic D&D like mini adventure, mini dungeon.
I love it when that's the kind of stuff that I love like that. For me, that's some of the stuff that really keeps being a DM interesting, where like you've got everything sort of plotted out and you're like, you think you've thought of what the logical things that will happen will be. And then the players completely blindside you and you have to sort of think on your feet. I like that.
And so in terms of like the reward they got for this, this job, they managed to get 150 gold. They found a potion of climbing and the bugbear had a rare blackwood shield that was worth 50 gold that I believe Arakendor took on to use as his shield. In the original module that I based this on, the shield is actually like a black dragon scale, but that whole adventure, Defiance in Flan, is sort of like flavored around like the dragon cult being the enemy, and so that's where like the dragon scale shield comes in. And since I was trying to do my own sort of thing, I instead had it be like rare blackwood from like the trees of the Land of Stench, basically from deep in the marsh.
Did the trees from the Land of Stench have stinky wood?
It probably doesn't smell great. It's probably like that tarry resin. And yeah, with the end of this of that little mission, they would have definitely hit level 3. This would have actually been like a separate session. But since, like, just for the sake of it, I'm just going to cover this next mini adventure as well. Technically, it's like the thing I'm about to talk about the third mini adventure out of 5. Really, what I think happened was like it was one session for the first adventure, one session for the one I just talked about with the Goblin Lair, and then the third session I covered adventures 3 and 4. And I'm going to leave 4 for the next time, but I'll do adventure 3 now. So, they've just gotten back from the Goblin Lair. Things were pretty tough. Like, generally, like everyone went down except for Chessie, and there was a time there where I was like pretty worried, although the player assured me that they had like tricks up their sleeves, so they seem pretty confident about it. They get back to the Barking Dog, and they are invited to a little sort of a VIP lunch with not just the hostess Abigail, but a celebrity, the drow bard Zeth Hexnat, who actually, this is a bit of a shout out to your game, he's like a traveling drow rock star.
Hey, right and, on.
He's come to play a show in Goblin Town. He's going to be playing a show that night at the Barking Dog. And so as a little treat for them while they're staying at the Barking Dog, Abigail has arranged for them to enjoy lunch with the illustrious Zeth Hexnat himself. I've also got the menu, like the meal here. We got rye buns, like burgers with rye buns and beef patties and bacon, goat cheese, hot sauce, and there's also some leftover fig cake from the night before and the breakfast. So basically having burgers with Zeth with a bit of fig cake afterwards. And this was also a chance. I did a bit of like, you know, background narrative work and stuff. Like they got to talk to Zeth about goings on, sort of like thing, like what's going on with the drow in the setting and whatnot.
I just want to say that Zeth Hexnat is a great name for a drow rock star.
Oh yeah, thank you. It's funny. I actually in Drail, there are 5 drow houses, and one of them is the one that Chessie is from, Dildira. There is Aishir, which are the ones we met in the previous campaign because they're loyal to the Nightside Eclipse. There is Derat, who we don't see a lot of, Dorende, who we don't see a lot of, and then there is Hexnat, which is actually, it's the name of like nomads who are not, it's like the house of the houseless, basically. So Zeth being a Hexnat is like he's not part of one of the really established ones. He's one of the more like nomadic drow houses, tend to be descended from exiles and whatnot from the other groups. Oh, actually, sorry, I got something wrong. I had this all set up like they had just come right back from the battle, but that's from the previous mission, but that's not correct. They come back from the mission, and they actually had a night before the next day with the lunch that I'm talking about. And that night, because the mission had been sort of difficult, and also because they had a free night, I let them do a bit of carousing. And so they did some drinking. I know that Nestle won some bottles of ink from a merchant in a like a drinking contest.
Yeah.
And this is also where they enjoyed their fig cake. But I also had them Aura Stormblast Kendor. He didn't really drink to excess, but Chessie and Nestle had to make a hangover check the next morning. Then at their late breakfast, that's where they enjoyed the leftover fig cake. They had ham, eggs, toast, milk, and fig jam. Alsamisath was out at the time. They got invited to the lunch. Abigail went out to harvest fish and corn and then come back because, like, that's for the big dinner that night. But then she comes back for the VIP lunch, and that's when they have the burgers. And they also enjoyed it with some good berry tea. And then they talked about Zeth's songwriting. They talked about his upcoming Underdark tour. But they also talked about something that was sort of a larger setting element, which is called the Drow Hospitality Campaign. The Drow Hospitality Campaign is basically the Drow houses in the Underdark were trying to express establish good relations with the goblins so that like there would be large numbers of goblins coming to the Drow houses in the Underdark. And really, like, the reasons for this are kind of they're not great. They're things like, you know, the Drow want the goblins to come to the Underdark for things like cheap labor and like easily manipulated like minions and followers for like weird cults and stuff. And it's funny because this is what eventually developed into a sort of historical analog that I have played with since developing this, of like basically the goblins are being brought into the Underdark on similar promises to like the Chinese railroad situation in North America historically. Is it's this idea of like the goblins are being sold a promise by the Drow that is actually just a way to benefit Drow society in terms of like providing them with cheap labor that they do not actually like have any sense of like responsibility for. But what it develops is the presence of goblin populations in the Underdark and throughout these areas, it's similar to the way that like that Chinese railroad legacy did eventually lead to like the establishment of what we know as like Chinatown and like a lot of the development of Chinese immigration, which started out obviously in this horrible labor exploitation situation, but has developed in this very historically rich way. And so similarly, you know, we've talked about having historical analogs in our game. And so this is my way of like seeding this idea of like the Drow Hospitality Campaign, the Drow and the Goblins, and like setting up this as an aspect of Drail.
I appreciate that you put that degree of thought into it, because it would just be very easy to be like, yeah, there are goblins here. Like, and I get the sense that even the players won't necessarily ever learn all the details, but the fact that it's like there's this logical reason to have it set up that way, I think really probably benefits the setting quite greatly.
And it's also, I think it's good to have it as like, because it was a scene where they were discussing it with Zeth. And so Zeth was able to, like, they were able to get sort of like different takes on it. Zeth being a Hexnat and being like a touring bard, like he doesn't have a lot of loyalty to like the more like Machiavellian tyrannical designs of the Drow houses. And so there was an extent to which I was able to say, like, you know, the conversation, it's just like a good conversation for this scene for role playing where they're talking about Zeth and whatnot. And then they get onto like, so goblins are like migrating en masse into the Underdark. And it's like, well, aren't the drow houses really hostile? And it's like, well, not in this case, but not really for good reasons either. And so it was just like provided a lot of, it provided a lot to role play with in that scene, I would say. after they're having this lunch, Al-Samsath arrives with a new job. And this one is actually a pretty standard MPOC routine job. Basically, there is a crypt in the creepy district of Goblin Town. Goblin Town is divided into a number of districts, including the Meat District, the Shiny District, the Creepy District, the Spooky District. These are all very, like, the Creepy District tends to be cemetery and stuff. Spooky District is, like, weird magic stuff and temples. Shiny District is, like, high-end commercial district.
I could have guessed most of those food. But I like the distinction between the creepy and the spooky.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if I just made that up now or like what if I'm mixing it up. But
wait. So there's a creepy district and a spooky district. Is there a kooky district and a mysterious district and an altogether?
I don't think so.
An altogether ooky district.
I mean, I may have made up the spooky district, or I may have misnamed the spooky district the creepy district, or I might have just fumbled it all up. Who knows? Point is, there's this crypt of a goblin pirate by the name of Captain Bam. And basically, there's just been some reports, you know, this is typical MPOC stuff. Reports of restless dead, undead in the crypt, MPOC. It's standard job to just go in, take down some undead. So they got to go clear out the crypt and then come back to the Barking Dog Inn for their reward and to enjoy dinner with a live music show from Zeth that evening. So they head on down to the creepy district. They go into the crypt. And basically, this was another very simple one where there's a chest that has a... Like, the chest is locked, but it also has, like, a poison needle trap, the old classic. And then, of course, if you open the chest, that's when the skeletons come to life. So, they had to look into the chest, see what was going on. There were all these, like, mosaics in the crypt of, like, the accomplishments of this pirate captain in life. And then there were, of course, also four pirate, goblin pirate zombies wandering around down there, in addition to the skeletons that sprang up when they opened the chest. They cleared out the place. They found some gems, three gems, each worth 50 gold. So they got 50 gold each. Then they got a scroll of comprehend languages from inside the chest. They got a scroll of protection from evil and good and 100 gold for completing the job. And I don't have here whether or not they figured out whether they disarmed the trap or not. But whatever the case, they cleared out that crypt, headed back to the Barking Dog. And I think I'll leave the next one for next time, where they show up at the Barking Dog in time for dinner with Zeth playing. Abigail's just harvested all they need for a big old feast. So they got corn on the cob and fish and eel, and it's a big old Zeth playing feast eating party time. But there may be something afoot, so be ready for that.
You gotta love those early level one adventures where it's a lot of pretty simple, like, A to B, go here, do the thing, kill the monster, and head back to the tavern.
Yep, you know, search that crypt, see if there's a dang old haunted chest. Turns out there was. That's not allowed. Get rid of those skeletons. Pirate captain, of course he's breaking the rules. Cursing his crypt and everything. So,
speaking of taverns.
Tavern time. I want to hit you with some tavern time while I've got it fresh in your memory, because what I brought to the tavern is I just wanted to talk about the actual Adventures League module some more that I based this these adventures off. So as I mentioned last time, this is Defiance in Flan. It's the first episode of the first season of the Adventures League for 5th edition, and it's basically five little mini adventures in the Forgotten Realms city of Flan. Based around the fact that the dragon cult is beginning to scheme and be active in the area. So last time I talked about the one I used for the previous adventure, where the players are asked to pose as buyers for a dragon egg, which turns out to be fake. So for the one with the goblin base, it's a similar setup where the players are at Madame Friona's tea kettle, the sort of like hub for these five adventures. A woman comes in saying that her family and some others have been kidnapped by goblins and dragged into the bog. There is the whole thing I was mentioning before about the tracking success chart, and you roll survival, and depending on how the players do, they are more or less successful at tracking through the bog, and that determines how many goblins are in the lair when they get there. There's also a little setup that I did not include where one of these dragon cultists is seen speaking to the goblins out front when the players arrive and then teleports away, which is just sort of like set up for the connection with the dragon cult. Basically, a dragon cultist has hired these goblins to kidnap people and steal anything that may be related to dragons, or just any money that might be or valuables that would be useful to the dragon cult's cause. So it's the lair of the Foulwater Goblin Tribe. It's generally as I ran it, so there's not a whole lot to talk about with that one. But what I also wanted to talk about was The Dead at High Sun, Mission 3, wherein the players are asked to check out a crypt in a cemetery, and the angle for this one is that basically there is a woman in the woman that the crypt belongs to. It's come to light to the keepers of the cemetery that the woman was not in fact a human, but actually a polymorphed green dragon. And so the job here is that the players are sent down into the crypt to sort of confirm the suspicions based on the remains inside. And what's funny is that the first thing when they go into the crypt is there's basically a puzzle room that, like, once they enter, once they disturb this sarcophagus that they open to get into the lower level of the crypt locks up and it's like a gas trap. The crypt starts filling with gas, similar to what you were talking about with the druid thing.
Hey, but yeah.
The thing about this is that I talked a bit earlier about how Chessie had gotten a ghillie suit and a hunting rifle for use in their mission. Can you think of another item that the MPOC often gives to their agents that would make this puzzle kind of trivial?
Sam Shepard glasses.
You're close.
Trioptics? No.
Nope. Think below.
Rebreather.
Rebreathers. They're immune to the gas attacks. This was a weak ass gas trap, and I was like, oh, they're gonna get stuck in the room, and that's just gonna be annoying for them. The gas isn't gonna hurt them at all. So I entirely cut that part out of the adventure, because it would have just been a bunch of MPOC dudes you know, a bunch of MPOC agents go into a room, get locked inside, and then get out, and there'd be like no real tension to it. So instead, that's why the mission was like a bit like it's a bit reduced in my case, because in my case, of course, I just had the chest with the trap and the skeletons and the zombies. I did not have any special thing about having to like open the sarcophagus to find the secret trap chamber below, because there was just no need to have like a gas trap, given what I had given the characters. There's also, in the adventure, the setup is basically, or like the end conclusion is that the dragon cult, was trying to get at this polymorphed green dragon to turn them into a dracolith. And so that's where the sort of like undead elements come in. And, in one area of the crypt labeled the reanimation chamber, there is a note written in common that says, "Raxil, I have figured out how to complete the process. When you are ready, simply pour the contents of this blue pot into the cauldron and stir. The effect should be instantaneous, but do not drink the resulting potion." Of course, they have included, "A character is foolish enough to drink the potion must make a DC 20 constitution saving throw or take 21 or 66 poison damage."
Oh my gosh.
For a low-level character, that's just death. But, I did think it was funny that they included this little, like...
I mean, you have to, you know, right? That's the thing. There's always someone in the party who's like, "Hey, drink it, though."
I didn't, but of course, that's because I was doing this whole... You know, this is for a dragon cult setup, and I was doing my own setup, basically. But there are also... flaring glyphs. So when they finally explore the crypt in the adventure, they find that this secret area is designed to be like a dragon's lair, basically, or like the crypt of a dragon. And then the zombies that they fight each have like draconic features, so they're sort of like dragon zombies, and then, or like dragonborn zombies more like. And then there's also these glyphs all over the, there's glyphs all over the room, but if you mar the glyphs, it blinds the zombies. The zombies are basically like seeing through the glyphs, which is, kind of an interesting puzzle, I thought, that they threw into it. It's also like the room has a teleportation circle and stuff, but the final reveal is basically like, oh, it looks like they were trying to make a dracolith out of this green dragon. But yeah, that's what I brought to the tavern.
Nice. That's a cool man. I gotta read more Adventurers League stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty fun. It's funny, all the seasons start with one of these packs of five mini adventures. So, and if you want one from Goblin Ink Press, you should check out Reef of Madness, which follows a similar setup.
Oh, yes, I have read that one. So what I brought to the tavern is I was doing some searching, because I always like to find sort of some of the quirky D&D features and things to bring to the tavern with me, and I was looking for ridiculous D&D spells, and I found this great list. It's on Gizmodo, written by Rob Bricken. It's 20 of the most useless Dungeons and Dragons spells ever. Now, I'm not going to go through all 20, but I will read some highlights, and then also I will point out some of Mr. Bricken's inclusions on this list that I disagree with. But we'll start with some funny ones. Are you familiar with the spell?
We gotta get True Strike?
I don't think True Strike is actually on here, no. Let's actually start with one I disagree with. He's got Tensor's Floating Disc on here. Disagree.
Okay.
I think Tensor's Floating Disc is actually really useful, especially if you've got a diminutive, well, not te- okay, a I got to be careful saying the size classifications because D&D actually uses like small and diminutive. If you have a character who is a smaller sized race, you could just put them on the disc. Like the Tensor's floating disc can be like Yoda's floating thing from the prequel, the Star Wars prequels. And
I guess even, the issue is, but the issue is, why would you do that instead of just cast fly?
I suppose, Tensor's floating disc can also carry loads for you. And even at a low level, the maximum load is 250 pounds. Like, you know, you can be like the Mandalorian and have your baby Yoda on a Tensor's floating disc. Like, why not? I see it as being, like, maybe it's not an amazing spell, but it is far from useless, in my opinion. Also, maybe you just don't have fly. Maybe you only have a scroll of Tensor's floating disc.
Man, I guess that's one situation. I was about to say, if you're some kind of spellcaster and you've got Tensor's floating disc, but you didn't have access to fly, I don't know what the fuck you were studying.
But here, let's talk about some useless ones. How about Basket Trick? You know that spell?
No, not familiar with this one.
So here's the write-up on it. In D&D, there is a reasonably useful...
Is it like Rope Trick?
It's kind of like Rope Trick. In D&D, there's a reasonably useful spell called Blink, which allows wizards to pop briefly to the astral plane, gives them a chance to move around, and then effectively they teleport a short distance when they come back to the material plane. Basket Trick is Blink, except you don't get to choose where you move. You pop back into the physical plane in a random nearby basket.
It's funny because I think Blink has changed in 5th edition.
Oh, has it?
Well, because I used to think of Blink as being something that you use to jump short distances. And, like, you do, but it's only 10 feet. Like, the real effect of Blink is that you cast a spell and then you disappear so that people can't hit you, so that you drop concentration on the spell. Like, that seems to be the real effect of Blink now.
Well, Basket Trick is Blink, except you don't get to choose where you even go. Instead, you pop back in a nearby basket, and you don't even get to pick the basket. It just teleports you to a nearby basket. And then, similarly, there's Beau Gentle's Fleeting Journey, where you can teleport to a known location for 1 minute and then immediately back to your point of origin. Now, I hear you say it's just like a 1 minute boomerang teleport. That's not so bad. However, it has a range of only 60 feet. So you can teleport 60 feet away for 60 seconds and then back to where you were.
I am over here. Now I am over here.
I am back. The spell Corpse Light. It makes corpses...
At least it's you said 60 seconds, right?
60 seconds, 60 feet.
At least that's 10 turns.
Yeah, that's true. However, if you have a running speed of 30, you could just dash there in one turn.
You might provoke opportunity attacks, though.
That's fair. But is it really worth casting Beau Gentle's Fleeting Journey instead?
Depends what level the spell is.
I like how our exercise now is concocting situations in which these spells might not be useless. Look, if you don't have fly as a spell, but you have a scroll of Tensor's floating disc, and you're halfling, maybe it's useful.
It's like, I don't know if you've ever seen RPG Bot, but that's a site that does like guidance on character optimization for 5th edition and stuff. Huh. And, you know, their angle is optimization and power gaming and stuff. So like their opinions tend to be pretty like harsh on that level, but I've got some pretty big disagreements with them on like what the best like warlock invocations are, because they say things like, there's no reason to take Eldritch Sight. You can already learn Detect Magic or whatever. It's like, No, I could cast Detect Magic for free at will whenever I want. I don't need anything. Or like they say, don't get Eyes of the Runekeeper, which Eyes of the Runekeeper is amazing. Eyes of the Runekeeper is just you can read all writing ever. It could be in code. It could be in a different language. You can just read it. And they're like, don't bother getting this. You should just get Ritual Caster, and then you can cast Comprehend Languages. It's like, no, first of all, Comprehend Languages only works with writing if you touch the writing. And one time, my brother had to touch a cursed stone just to read the writing. It was hurting him just to read the writing because he was taking the damage from the cursed stone. You dingus.
What about Corpse Light, Tom? When do you take Corpse Light?
What's Corpse Light?
It makes corpses glow.
When you're cleansing the Den of Evil.
I guess. Why not just use light?
Because then every corpse that glows, you know, okay, I got that one. Do you know what I'm referencing here with the Den of Evil?
The Den of Evil. It sounds familiar.
In Diablo 2, the first quest is to cleanse the Den of Evil.
Right.
And there's like a specific number of zombies you have to kill in a cave. So what I'm saying is throw out Corpse Light, and then the number of glowing zombies tells you how many zombies you have left to kill in that cave.
I think it only works on one at a time, though.
Oh, that's annoying.
It's just like the spell Light, except you need a corpse.
Flavorful.
Okay, Decastave. Now, are you familiar with Decastave?
These are some deep cuts, my man.
Decastave transforms a small piece of wood into a 10-foot-long pole. Now, I have espoused the virtues of the 10-foot pole previously. However, Rob Bricken points something out here. He says, for perspective, 10 feet is the length of the shortest possible pole vaulting pole. Imagine trying to fight someone with a pole vaulting pole in a dungeon where the length of the hallway is probably exactly 10 feet wide. I can see how that might be a problem. However,
well, it's not for fighting, though.
No, it's not. I do like the image, though, of having a small piece of wood and then casting Decastave and having it like ram into your opponent from 10 feet away.
And then class Shillelagh on that. On that Decastave.
Heck yeah. Otto's Irresistible Dance.
This is a classic.
Heck yeah. Cast this, which, as its title suggests, forces its target to dance uncontrollably to the exclusion of all else. In terms of incapacitating an opponent, it's undeniably goofy. And it could be useful, but it's an 8th level spell. At which point, wizards are actually traveling like through dimensions and creating giant clouds of fire, bending entire groups of monsters to their will, driving people insane. So making someone do a jig doesn't sound as useful. Now, in this case, maybe it's not that useful, but it is entertaining.
Yeah, they took it down to 6th level for 5th edition.
So, hey, you want a point of disagreement with this list? Number 15 on Rob Bricken's list of the 20 most useless D&D spells is Shillelagh.
I mean, I don't use it a whole lot, but I know people who do, so...
Man, the mini campaign that you DM'd for me and a couple of our friends not that long ago... Liam, I'll name drop him, Liam, he was casting Shillelagh all the time.
Yeah, casting it on a musket so he could whack you good with a rifle butt.
I mean, why not? Quincy's Enchanting Gourmet. It cooks you a grand meal and then cleans up the kitchen afterwards. Now that one's pretty funny because, like, cleaning up the kitchen afterwards, I feel like, in the context of an adventure, nobody, not even the DM, is likely to care. But B...
Also, if it's a magic spell, why doesn't it just, like... Shouldn't all magic spells just clean themselves
up?
Yeah,
really. But B, like, not only would the DM not really care I don't assume if you didn't clean up...
I don't assume that Hero's Feast leaves a lot of spoiling food around if you don't eat it all.
Exactly. But not only that, like... even if the players were like, I want to clean up the kitchen afterwards, at least if I was DMing an adventure where somebody said that, I'd be like, okay, you do that. Like, it's over in a sentence. You're like, okay, you clean it up. Like, I'm not going to make them spend any time on it. I'll conclude with Snilox Snowball.
Man, I was just thinking about this one, and I was like, man, they better not... They're just dropping all the good name ones, but Snilox Snowball is a classic.
It is a classic, but... What use do you have for it?
A cold damage based spell attack.
I mean, I suppose. It doesn't do much damage, though.
Yeah, but like, I don't know. What else are you going to do? A cone of cold? That's like sixth level or something, fifth level.
I guess. But when... I feel like it has a very narrow use. And in this case, I do agree with Mr. Bricken, who says it's sort of like the embarrassing version of Magic Missile.
Man, this is so, like, I don't know. In 5th edition, it's so much better than Magic Missile. In 5th edition, it's a 5-foot radius sphere, so up to 4 enemies. And it does 3d6 cold damage on a failed save, half on a success. And you can upcast it to increase the damage by 1d6 per level.
I mean... Well, goddamn.
That's a quality, like, especially if you have a character that's tailored to do extra cold damage, that's like a quality pre-cone of cold cold damage attack, I would say.
You know what?
It's only second level.
You know what? I've come around to it. Bricken is wrong.
I think it's just an issue of 5th edition making a lot of these things better. And like,
yeah, I think some of these things have been updated. Though I maintain...
You mentioned that banquet one, and I was like, well, we have Heroes Feast, and that does way better stuff and doesn't have any weird, like, idiosyncrasies.
I maintain that Tensor's Floating Disc is good, though. I mean, it has a better carrying capacity than a backpack, even. Like, if your DM and your players are paying attention to actually how much weight... they're carrying, then Tensor's Floating Disc, like, just have it follow you around the dungeon and put all the loot on it. Anyway, you listeners can look up 20 of the most useless Dungeons and Dragons spells ever, written by Rob Bricken on Gizmodo, and debate them amongst yourselves.
I just realized in 5th edition, Floating Disc is a first level ritual conjuration. There's no reason not to.
I mean, yeah, why not?
And it can hold up to 500 pounds. It's pretty small, though. It's only 3 feet in diameter and 1 inch thick.
3 feet in diameter, but like I said, like, you know, if you've got, like, a halfling rogue in your party and you don't have fly, then you can put the rogue on your disc and send it somewhere that, you know, if he needs to get in some high-up window, why not? Oh, well, okay, you know what? I was wrong. There's one more that I should mention, which is Guise of the Yak Man.
Oh, man, that sounds dope.
It literally, the spell makes the target appear as a vile yak man. As far as all physical senses are concerned, look, smell, hear a yak man. Only a true seeing spell can pierce the illusion.
And this is just a very specific polymorph.
A very specific polymorph, but it's really more of a curse, and its use in 2nd edition, it's a 2nd edition spell, is it can only be dispelled through a wish.
Damn.
So you force someone to look and smell and sound like a yak man, even though they're not.
Well, oh man.
So,
there's going to be plenty to talk about this new campaign of mine, Al's Aces, I'll tell you that.
You know what? If I were ever playing D&D with Hugh Jackman, just cast Guise of the Yak Man, make Hugh Jackman into a huge yak man.
Maybe that's what K-Ball from Mortal Kombat looks like under his face, under his mask. Well, it seems like that was another episode. An episode 47, you would say. on the 26th of January, 2021. If you want to get in touch with me, I'm Narnog, at Narnog, NAR_NOG on Twitter. You can hit us up on Facebook, Compare a Campaign on Facebook, and follow us on Spotify, follow us on Facebook, like us on Facebook, follow us on our various podcast applications, but also, most importantly, check out our WordPress, compareandcampaign.wordpress.com, where we keep things like show notes, the map of Drail on the second or first post, and yeah, all that good stuff that you need to understand what we're talking about, or maybe to just have a glimpse at what we're saying. But whatever the case, I'm Tom Lando saying, not me.
Get that ding.
Take care, everybody.